All right, so we are live. So welcome everybody to another one of my webinars. This is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems. And in this webinar, I'm gonna go over upper body cardio training and really how it's probably the missing link in your mountain bike cardio training program and give you some cool ideas on using some old school training tools to help you out with that. So first, just wanna cover a couple things. I see I've got some people live with me, so appreciate everybody who took the time out of their day to join me live. You've got the little chat thing over there on the right-hand side. You can introduce yourself, say hi. Remember, you can ask questions. I'm going to be doing a little slide presentation here in a minute, and while I'm doing that, I won't be able to see your questions as they pop up, but as soon as I'm done, I'll be able to see them and get to them. So make use of that little chat thing on the side. This is one of the things I love about doing the webinars, is getting the chance to interact with you guys while I do it. And then after the webinar, I'll open it up to just kind of a general Q&A so you guys can ask me anything about this webinar or just kind of anything in general that might be on top of your head there. So anyways, got Amanda saying hi. How's it going, Amanda? So real quick, I know a lot of people watching this know who I am, but in case you don't, like I said, my name is James Wilson. I own MTB Strength Training Systems. I've been helping mountain bikers in all disciplines and all levels of riding since 2005. Learn how to use smart strength and mobility training to help improve their riding. And it was really kind of a journey. I call myself the accidental mountain bike coach because I never set out to become a mountain bike coach. I wanted to become a better rider myself. And so I set out to kind of find the best ways to become a better rider. I'm not a natural talent by any stretch of the imagination. I have this funny story I tell people about how I wrecked off of an 8-inch curb riding my bike to work today. I swear to God, true story. It was very embarrassing. But the point is that I started to find these different things that helped me improve my riding, and I knew that they would help other riders. And so I started MTB Strength Training Systems to help share this information with you. And so, yeah, I got some other people, Greg from Pomona, they all saying hi. Oh, from Israel, excellent. Thanks for taking the time to join us. Doug, Philippe, man, everybody, hi. Appreciate you guys saying hi and joining me. So the upper body cardio thing, it started, it was kind of a weird journey for me because what happened was I had a pinched nerve in my neck. And it's one of those things that most of us in today's society just kind of get used to. Like when we say our neck feels fine, it really means that it's not like out of whack and really hurting us that day. But we get used to this, you know, just kind of low level of tension, low level of just kind of like, you know, whatever in the neck area. And a lot of it's just from doing what I'm doing right now. We spend so much time in this position, and then we're on our bikes like this. And so I kind of had this this breaking point, and I realized like, man, there's something that's really like missing from my training. I'm doing all the quote unquote right stuff. I'm doing the mobility. I'm doing the strength training. I'm doing my Turkish get-ups. I'm doing all that stuff. It just seems like something's missing. And around that time, I kind of started, my mind started to get turned towards using some old school training tools, particularly the mace, also known as the gada, and the Indian clubs. And the kettlebells fall into this category as well. And I'll talk about all this stuff here a little bit later. But those tools and researching them and learning more about them and using them and seeing the results that I saw was just like, wow, there's really something here. Like, why do not more people know about these training tools and how to use them? And especially mountain bikers, because I started to realize like a lot of these training tools were developed by ancient warriors and ancient wrestlers. And you know, you talk about like upper body strength and grip strength and upper body endurance. I mean, those guys had to have it in spades. And so, and that's mountain biking. There's a lot of that in mountain biking. So anyways, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over a little slide presentation. And again, the slides are my notes. And so it's more to keep me on track so I don't get too far off in left field, as I've been known to do. And so I'm going to go through the slides, give you a little bit of background on what's going on. And then I'm going to take some time and I'm going to show you some of my favorite exercises with these tools and kind of how you can use them in your program. And yeah, just kind of go from there. So anyways, this is something totally new. I mean, I got to believe that if I'm not the first, I've got to be one of the first guys who's really trying to bring the steel mace and the Indian clubs and the stuff at this level to you guys and show you guys some of the stuff for specifically for mountain biking. So anyways, just have to bear with me as I'm it's all kind of new to me too, but I really was excited about it and want to share it with you guys. So all right. So see a bunch more people saying hi. Man, got people from all over. the country, all over the world joining me. Appreciate it. We got somebody from Laguna Beach, man. I'm jealous. We're so cold right here right now. Anyways, so I'm going to do my little screen share thing, start the slide presentation, and go over the info, and then, show you some exercises. So, and again, as you guys get questions or anything that pop up, please just put them in the chat box. I won't be able to see them, like I said, while I'm doing the presentation, but I'll get to them as soon as I get done. So here we go. Just give me a second to do my little thing. And where are you? There you are. All right. Took us into Infinity World there for a second. There we go. All right. I know there's a better, easier way to do this, but this is just how I get it done. So there we go. Upper body cardio training. Old school tools for today's modern mountain biker. So I like to start this off with a question. What athlete has the highest VO2 max on record? Raise your hand if you know the answer. Obviously, I can't see you raising your hand, but a few people probably know this, but a lot of people would be probably surprised to find out that it's not who they might think it is. It's actually Nordic skiers. Nordic skiers have the highest recorded VO2 max of any athlete out there. In fact, the cyclists are actually down the list a little bit. The VO2 max is way lower. I mean, way comparatively speaking, compared to a Nordic skier and even runners. And so why is that? The reason is because there's an upper body component. The Nordic skiers use all four limbs. And so there's a higher overall cardiovascular demand and also very specific cardiovascular demands that are unique to their sport that get them to this high VO2 max. So, why is this important? Why do we need to, know this? Well, because it brings us to the eternal question, what is cardio? And, cardio, I've talked about this, I've mentioned this in blog posts, it's one of those terms that gets thrown around very loosely, and very few people who use it, especially in the mountain biking world, really understand exactly what they're talking about, because they use it interchangeably with endurance, which it's not. And this is where things get confusing, because cardio refers specifically to your cardiovascular system. So, but beyond that, cardio is not a gas tank that you draw from. There's this kind of analogy and this mindset that we have that our cardio is just, like I said, like a gas tank. And so as we build our quote unquote cardio, we're adding to this gas tank. And then we can draw from this gas tank when we need it. That's not necessarily untrue, but that's an overly simplistic view of what cardio training does for you. And so again, this idea of there being a gas tank and that, we just need to work on our cardio and that's going to build this gas tank. And then when we're out on the trail riding, then we're going to be able to draw from this gas tank. Like, this is where the idea of like spending hours and hours on a road bike is going to help you on the trail, because you're building your cardio when you're working out, when you're riding a road bike on the road. But that's, the gas tank, your idea is I'm building this gas tank, but that's not, a lot of people who spent time on a road bike and then get on the trail realize like, wait a minute, there's more to it. And so cardio is the ability for your cardiovascular, nervous, and muscular systems to support a specific activity. So basically what this means is that cardio, your cardiovascular system is the central part of that. But your nervous system and your muscular system play very important roles in that too. So for example, if your brain recognizes what is about to happen, it recognizes the positions and the demands and everything that's happening, then it can respond efficiently and tell your body, okay, here's the muscles that need to activate, here's the muscles that need to relax, here's the hormones that need to be released, all of this stuff. And so your nervous system plays a very important role because it actually controls the muscles. So without the nervous system, your cardiovascular system has nothing to fuel. And so in the muscular system, again, if you don't have a muscular system, your cardiovascular system has nothing to fuel. The nervous system helps create the movement and regulate the energy production and stuff like that. The muscular system uses the energy. So inside the muscles themselves, you have both, the stored glycogen, but you also have the mitochondria and all of the, the energy systems within the specific muscles themselves. And then you have your cardiovascular system, which provides the fuel to support that work. And so again, when you realize like cardio is not just my cardiovascular system, I have to keep in mind my nervous system and my muscular system as I'm training my cardio and for these specific activities. And so examples of this, one, seated versus standing paddling. I'm very, very big on this. This is, you know, the cardio that you build seated is not going to transfer to standing very effectively. And so obviously if you have a rider who's really fit and he spent a lot of time seated pedaling, and you have a rider who's completely unfit and you both have them start to try doing some standing pedaling, obviously the general kind of just fitness base or whatever you want to call it, like I don't want to make it sound like there's zero transfer at all. That's not true. There is some transfer, but it's very limited and it's not nearly what you would think. And so this is why standing training seated and standing pedaling separately is very important, because from a muscular system standpoint, from your brain's point of view, those two things are very different. And so your cardiovascular system has to respond differently and supply fuel differently for those two different activities. Example two, triathletes. So, you know, why triathletes, they run, bike, and swim. You know, if cardio was just cardio and there was just this gas tank that you drew from, well, then they could just do one of those three. You know, they could just build their cardio running, biking, or swimming. But instead, they have to spend time training all three, because the cardiovascular system has to know how to respond to and support all three activities. And last is Lance Armstrong. And this is the example. You know, he ran the marathon, I forget, it was the New York or Boston Marathon, back in his heyday, you know, when he was, you know, the top endurance athlete in the world. And yet he finished like kind of mid-pack. He wasn't at the top of the pack. So, you know, it also points to VO2 max testing. Like when they test a runner's VO2 max while he's running, there's a very, he usually tests higher than if they test it cycling, and vice versa. You take a cyclist and test their VO2 max cycling, and then you test it running, and it's not unusual. It's very common to see differences, sometimes large differences, in the numbers that are reached. So again, if cardio is cardio, then none of these examples should exist, right? So what this means is that we have to get beyond kind of some of the current views of cardio training. So this means that cardio is very specific to what parts of the body are being used and how they are being used. And this goes back to the Nordic skier example of, you know, they use their arms. And so, you know, they're not just using their legs, they're using their arms. And so you can't train for Nordic skiing by just training one or the other. You have to train the upper body and the lower body. And you also have to keep in mind how they're being used. You can't train for this by, you know, training on an exercycle for your legs and then using an exercycle for your upper body and then saying, okay, now I'm training for Nordic skiing. You know, there's, you have to look at the specific tension demands, movement demands, the joint angles, and also, you know, what parts of the body are being used. And so the upper body is an important part of your performance in some sports, like mountain biking. Mountain biking has a huge upper body component. In fact, the upper body demands in mountain biking are much higher than for road riding. And so this is another reason that I continually try to, you know, drum into people's heads that mountain biking and road riding are separate sports. You have to stop looking at them as the same sport or just kind of a different variation of the same sport. Just because you're on a two-wheel bike does not mean that they're the same sport. From your body's point of view, from your brain's point of view, from your muscular system's point of view, and also, you know, from your cardiovascular system's point of view, all of those points of view, mountain biking is much different. The upper body demands are huge on the trail, and anyone who's been on the trail can attest to this. And this is one of the problems, is that people's upper bodies are so weak and their upper body cardio is so horrible. They get out on the trail, they get beat up, they're working so hard because they have these weak links in their system, but they feel themselves breathing hard. So what's the answer? Hey, I need to work on my cardio. Well, how do you work on your cardio? Well, you pedal. It doesn't make sense, right? So there was a study that found that grip strength endurance and not pedaling-based aerobic endurance was directly related to downhill racing performance. And I have a article on my site called The Science of Going Downhill Faster that links to the study if you want to check it out. But, again, even if you don't race downhill, which most people really don't, there's still something there, because every time the trail starts pointing down, you're not pedaling, there's something else that becomes important. And that's what they're finding, is that this grip strength endurance is an extremely important part of your performance as a mountain biker, because when you're not pedaling, when the trail is rough, and especially when you're going downhill, that grip strength endurance becomes the most important factor. And if that's a weak link, if you don't have good grip strength endurance, it means your body's going to be working very inefficiently. You're going to be burning energy very inefficiently. So when you get to the parts that don't require grip strength endurance, you don't have as much energy to put into those things. And again, people confuse that as thinking they need to work on pedaling. So in fact, pedaling-based aerobic endurance has never been found to be directly related to MTB performance. So you can't look at someone's VO2 max and say, oh, he's got the highest VO2 max, he's going to win this mountain bike race. That's not how it works. And yet, in this previous thing here, like I pointed out, this study found like, oh, he's got the highest grip strength endurance. Yeah, you can bet money that he'll probably finish at the top of this downhill race. So, you know, there's been a direct correlation between some sort of mountain bike performance and grip strength endurance. Well, there's been no correlation between pedaling-based aerobic endurance and mountain biking anywhere. And yet we continue to obsess over it. You know, like I keep going back to people, when they need to work on their cardio, what do? They cardio training equals pedaling. We have to move past this idea that cardio training equals pedaling. And this gets past the idea that pedaling equals cycling. You know, like, well, cycling again is code word for road riding. And if you're gonna tell me that pedaling equals road riding, I wouldn't argue with you there, because that's a huge aspect. Like, you, people forget that, you know, people, but road riders don't ride road bikes to improve their cardio. They ride road bikes because that's their sport and they're getting better at their sport. And so, you know, if we're not road riders, then doing the things that they do to get better at their sport isn't the best thing. So that's where this whole pedaling equals cardio training comes from. Is looking at road riders, not realizing that their cardio demands are different than ours, and that, you know, we have an upper body component. So how do you train upper body cardio? Because again, I can't stress this enough. This upper body cardio is a huge missing link in most people's cardio training. They continue to obsess over pedaling based cardio when it's their upper body cardio that's really holding them back on the trail. So here's the little simple equation that I've come to realize over the past several months of training and looking into this stuff. And I mean, really, it's been more than the past several months. This is like years of different stuff. It's just kind of funny. There's this thing called the adjacent possible, this book I read called Where Good Ideas Come From. And it's basically where, you know, when you have all of this knowledge from these weird, you know, different areas, and sometimes these different things converge at a moment, and you're able to kind of see over the edge, as he described it, and see like what's possible. And so the last few months have been a culmination of years of things that have come together for me and kind of crystallized over the last few months. And that's what, you know, this equation comes from, and a lot of stuff comes from. But my point is that grip strength endurance equals core strength endurance equals upper body endurance. So again, going back to that study that found that grip strength endurance was directly related to their performance. Well, there's a guy named Gray Cook, who I mentioned quite a bit. He's the guy who came up with the functional movement screen, one of the leaders in the functional movement, if you want to call it that. But he's got a saying called, your grip strength is a window to your core, or your grip is a window to your core. And so your grip strength and your core strength are directly related to each other. And so your grip strength is directly related to your core strength. And the better those two things are, the better your upper body endurance is going to be. So the idea is not just to worry about, you know, core strength, it's to worry about grip strength endurance as well. And that's going to like help play into all of this. So as I mentioned earlier, the ancients, you know, which is this word for people that lived hundreds and thousands of years ago and sometimes gets a little over romanticized. It's funny, I read a lot of old history books, and even back in like old Rome, they had people who were romanticizing the past. I forget the name, but they actually had a word for it. So this is something that humans have been doing for a long time. So I want you guys to understand, you always got to take stuff with a grain of salt. You know, the ancients definitely had some knowledge and stuff that we can take advantage of, but I'm definitely not hearkening back to like living in caves and stuff like that. I like my Xbox and internet and stuff. So anyways, point is, ancients, they understood the need for upper body cardio and they developed systems to train it. So again, if you were an ancient, and you know, talking to somebody that lived, you know, 1,000, 2,000 plus years ago, you know, your day consisted of a lot of upper body stuff. You were probably a farmer. And, you know, if you weren't a farmer, than you were a hunter, or, you know, you definitely, people had to fight, you know. I mean, they talk about, if you ever read the Iliad, I mean, these guys fought hand-to-hand combat with swords, shields, and spears for like hours all day long. I mean, you talk about upper body freaking cardio, man, like, you know, swinging swords and spears and shields around for hours at a time. That was a reality of their life. You know, Vikings rowing their warships, you know, Roman soldiers just like marching all over God's creation and freaking, you know, then setting up camp and, you know, kicking ass and taking names right after. I mean, all of this stuff required high degrees of upper body cardio and overall body cardio, really. But, you know, again, the lower body stuff is what gets emphasized with like running and cycling. And so we're kind of looking at some of this upper body stuff. So they had systems for how to train this stuff. The knowledge has been lost since it can't be put into a box and it's not easily measured in a lab. You know, for example, like a Mace 360, which I'm about to show you guys here in a little bit, you know, what muscle group does that work? You know what I mean? So even me, I'm a big guy about coaching like movement patterns and stuff. So like, hey, push, pull, hinge, squat. And I got to be totally honest with you. I'm starting to realize there's some limitations even to those boxes. Because again, where do you put Indian clubs? Where do you put the mace? You know, where do you put some of these things? They don't fit into these boxes. And so it's not easy to, you know, program them. It's not as easy to, you know, you can't measure them in a lab. This is another reason that pedaling-based fitness is so emphasized. People forget, like, you know, science studies what it can study. And then we get this idea that, well, whatever it studies must be the most important thing. Well, it can easily study, you know, pedaling-based fitness. They can, you know, measure your RPMs, your power output, your heart rate, your, you know, the gases being inhaled and exhaled. There's all of these things that they can measure. And then they can, like, go over 6 weeks, show, like, oh, see, he had an increase in these lab measurements and this measurement here and this measurement here. And so it's very easy to measure, and it's very easy for coaches to set up programs based on this stuff and say, like, all right, you know, we're going to have this number of mileage this week and this number of mileage this week and this percentage at this, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's so easy to measure the pedaling based stuff. You start getting into the upper body stuff and it just becomes this real fuzzy world. And a lot of coaches don't like to live in fuzzy worlds. They like very clear cut boxes. They like rules, and those rules never change. And that's just how things are. And so anyway, so that's why you've probably never heard about a lot of this stuff. That's why I know I haven't heard about a lot of this stuff. So by finding ways to tap into this lost knowledge, you can gain an edge in your mountain bike training. And that's basically what I want to show you guys to do. And the edge that you guys can gain is significant. In fact, this is, you know, the first exercise here, I'm gonna go ahead and skip to it, is kettlebells. And kettlebells are kind of the new kid on the old school block, if you want to call them that, because they're only a few hundred years old, whereas these other two tools that I'm about to show you are thousands of years old. And so the kettlebell was you know, originally developed and popularized in Russia. A lot of people know the story about kettlebells today because a guy named Pavel Sotsalin back in the late 90s, you know, started to introduce kettlebells back into the American fitness market and started to become very popular. And again, though, the kettlebells, you know, this is just one of those things. I just happened to be at certain places at certain times. And again, if I wasn't the first, I was probably one of the first to use kettlebells with my mountain bike clients, especially things like swings and Turkish get-ups. And it's funny, a lot of exercises that people just take, you know, for granted today are just like, oh yeah, that's what you do as a mountain biker. It's like, yeah, you know, back when I started MTB Strength Training Systems in 2005, I was pretty much the first person to start talking about using kettlebells and how to properly use them for mountain bike training. So again, I'm sure there were other people that were using them. My point is that I was one of the first people to help popularize them in the mountain biking world, one of the first people to start using them in my programs, especially my online programs. And I'll admit, I think that that is the number one reason that my programs have produced the results and gotten the reputation that they have over time, is because I have a heavy dose of kettlebells in my program, which includes a heavy dose of swings and you know, a lot of these things, even like Turkish get-ups and stuff like that, work on your upper body cardio because of the endurance factor, having stabilized your arm over your head for so long. So this upper body endurance thing, this is what I'm saying, like, I didn't realize, you know, when I started using kettlebells back in 2005, the idea of upper body and grip strength endurance wasn't even entering my mind. And when I saw people getting great results from using the kettlebells, and I'm trying to, like, you know, there's a lot of reasons you're using, you know, the hips. It's a good practice for your body position. And there's just so many good reasons. But now I'm starting to realize that, really one of the secret weapons there is that's upper body cardio. When you're doing swings and you're working that grip strength endurance and you're having to hang on to that kettlebell, you're getting that overall body, you're adding that you know, upper body cardio grip strength endurance aspect to your training. And so anyways, my point is that kettlebells are awesome. I'm going to show you guys a couple other tools that I really love, but the kettlebell definitely falls in this category. The kettlebell swing is one of the best mountain bike specific cardio training exercises that you can do from just a movement standpoint and all that. So the swing, the clean, and then also your combo drills and flows are kind of the top three things that you can use kettlebells for. And so kettlebells work real well because you can do a swing into a clean, into a shoulder press, you know, into a squat or a lunge. You know, you can easily flow several exercises together. And so again, you start to get away from some of the specific upper body cardio, but you're, you know, working that overall body cardio and making sure you have a heavy upper body aspect. I guess that's the idea, is you don't want to, like, get rid of the lower body. You just want to make sure you have a good, strong, heavy body, upper body cardio training aspect in your program. So kettlebells, those are the top three things. I'm going to show you guys these exercises and go over a couple of cues I like to use for them here in just a second. Indian clubs are even older by quite a bit. They go back, you know, thousands of years. They're originally developed in Persia. They made their way over to India, and the British soldiers over there noticed that the Indians, particularly the wrestlers, and had just really great upper body development and strength and endurance and all of these things. And they trained regularly with the Indian clubs. And so they, that's why they're called Indian clubs, is because, you know, how we all were back in the day, just to not asking questions and just assuming that what you saw was what it was, and saying, hey, these people are from India, they're using them, so they're Indian clubs, instead of finding out, oh, they're actually from Persia and made their way over here. But so you can call, they're also called club bells in some circles. But the Indian clubs are an amazing training tool. They're probably right now my favorite training tool. The swing, which I'll show you, is an amazing exercise, and I really like it because you can get into more specific stances with this swing than you can with a kettlebell swing. The side swing, where you start to work on some lateral movements, and then also you can use Indian clubs to flow a bunch of drills together as well. And so really strong grip training, grip strength endurance aspect with the Indian clubs. And then finally, the steel mace, also known as the gada. And again, developed a couple thousand years ago in Persia, originally just a rock on the end of a stick. And it, you know, has been used since then by warriors and wrestlers in that area. And probably, like, best known, there was a guy named the Great Gama. And he was one of the last great Indian Kushti wrestlers back in the early 1900s, back when wrestling was a big deal. Like, there was a point in time when wrestling, you know, wasn't the fake stuff, you know, you see at WWE, and it's nothing wrong with that. I like WWE. But the point is that wrestling used to be like one of the major sports, and people, you know, it was a big deal. And there was a guy named the Great Gama, and he was known for using the mace and, you know, almost like excessive use of it. I think I saw a term when reading up on him. He was known for his excessive use of the mace. But so they got the 360s, the 10 and 2s, and I made up the dance of death. And I'm going to show you that one just because it's really fun. I actually had one guy come over, and he did that, showed him the dance of death, and he tried it. He was like, that's the funnest exercise I've ever done in my life. And he went home and bought him a steel mace, and he's been just loving it ever since. So I'm going to show you guys that. But the steel mace is another fun training tool, and I'll show you guys some stuff with that. So you can also put them together. I mean, right now I'm loving doing kettlebell swings and mace 360s. I mean, you talk about an amazing overall body workout, you know, doing like 20 swings and 20 360s and alternating back and forth. You can do, you know, your Indian club swings and, you know, 10 and 2s. You can combine all three of them using swings and side swings. So I'll show you some of these combinations. But the thing, you know, one of the downfalls, if you want to call it a downfall, of the kettlebell is that, you know, you can only do so many freaking swings in a row. you know, and we're not here to become professional swingers. You can take that however you want. But I mean, like, you know, you need to get good at swings, but I know some people can pump out just like, you know, oh, I can just keep passing off hands and blah, blah, blah. That's great, man. You spend a ton of time swinging. I need to ride my bike. So, you know, being able to combine swings with Indian club exercises or mace exercises, so you're able to keep working and you're able to keep challenging your grip and your cardiovascular system, but in slightly different ways, so you keep the work going. So instead of doing swings and resting, swings and resting, swings and resting, you're able to do, you know, swings 360, swings 360, swings 360, and you can keep going doing that for 5-10 minutes. And so anyways, so that's some ways to kind of combine this stuff. So you can learn more and get a free 30-day workout at bikejames.com. And all right, so that's it. I'm gonna stop sharing, get out of here, see if I got any questions, and then I'm gonna show you guys some of the exercises. And there we are. Yeah, Rick got my pro swinger pun. All right, so I'm gonna take a quick look at a couple questions here. I'm gonna kind of let's see here we are. Amanda wants to know, we had a lot of banter going on in the little chat room, which I love to see. It pumps me up to see you guys chatting with each other while I'm doing my presentation. I'm like answering and asking each other's questions. So so Amanda is asking, can VO2 max be trained and increased, or is this mostly hereditary? That's a great question. It's really mostly, you know, I'm going to say it's mostly hereditary. All right. So here's the problem. There's a good book called The Sports Gene, because we run into this problem, right? We've heard the 10,000 hour rule, and then we've heard that it's genetics. And the truth is, it's a combination of the two. You know, there's some genetic factor. There's some training. I mean, there's people that don't have very high VO2 maxes that have gone on to become great endurance athletes, you know, and then there's guys that have really great natural talent that didn't have to work quite as hard to become great. You know what I mean? So it's always a combination of the two. But the thing is that there's definitely, you know, a limit to what you can do. And the other thing is that your ability to increase your VO2 max is very limited compared to your ability to improve your efficiency. And so this is, again, like your efficiency, that there is, you look, there's another book called 80-20 Running that does a great job of explaining this. But he talks about how, you know, there's a lot of great runners whose VO2 max is leveled off or even decreased, and yet you see their performance continue to rise. Why? Why? Because there's something more going on. You know, there's way more going on than just your VO2 max. Like, if people understood the history of sports science, they'd understand it's just basically the history of, like, their ability to measure aerobic exercise. And it's not necessarily there's not necessarily studying, like, you know, anyways, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit off topic there. But VO2 max, it's not that it's not important. It just gets overplayed, and you're not necessarily trying to train to improve that. You're after your first year or two of riding, the vast majority, especially as you get older, like once you get into like your 30s and 40s, the vast majority of any performance improvements are coming from efficiency. And as we're keeping, you know, how does the brain perceive this, and how is the body perceiving this? You know, the muscles and stuff like that become more specific. And so hopefully that answers your question, man. Let me know if not, and I'll be happy to follow up on that. Let's see. Can you overdo cardio? Yeah. So here's the thing. Douglas wants to know if you can overdo cardio. And back up here a second. There's riding your bike, which is cardio training. It's practicing your sport. It's the most important cardio training that you can do. And then there's cardio training, which is what I consider like not on the trail, like what you're going to do in addition to riding your bike. Like trail riding is the most important cardio training you can do, and it should be the focus of your program. And if we're talking about, you know, extra stuff beyond that, it needs to support your bike riding. If you're getting, like, you know, two good hard trail rides in a week, how many hard cardio efforts can you put in each week? You know what I mean? So the reality is that most riders are overdoing cardio training, in my opinion. I think that you see this guy, Ian King, who's a strength coach, Australian strength coach, who pointed this out first, but people get into this overtraining syndrome, right? So they think that working really hard is the key. So they work really hard, and then they don't see the results they want. So they think they need to work harder, which starts to kind of overtrain them. And then the performance decreases, which freaks them out. And they think, I need to work harder. And the same thing happens with the cardio training, because people start out and they're out of shape and they start doing some cardio training and they see results, but then the results stop coming. And so they think, I need to work harder. And then the results actually, they don't come, or they see some decrease because they're starting to overtrain themselves. So my point is that I found that most people can put in about 2 good hard cardio efforts each week, and that the bulk of your cardio training should be moderate to easy, really. And again, you go back to that 80-20 book, 80% of your cardio training should fall into like the you know, he says easy. That it gets a little fuzzy with us as mountain bikers, but in my opinion, I think that your, you know, 80% of your riding should fall into the moderate to easy category, and 20% in the hard. And your cardio, you're only doing hard cardio if you're not able to get out on the trail and practice. Like when I was a runner, the only reason I got into the gym and went on a treadmill, or I went into the pool and did pool running, or I did some other sort of thing besides get on the track, was because I couldn't get on the track. That was it. So if you can get on the trail, you know, then you should be looking at how to use that. So, but anyways, I guess my point is I'm starting to get a little off topic here, because cardio is one of those things, like I could just do a cardio training webinar and just for hours go off on this stuff, because there's so many questions, so many misconceptions. So I always look at, to sum it up, I always look at minimal effective dosage. It's not how much can you survive. It's how little can you do and see the results you're looking for. And remember, the trail riding is ultimately, everything else needs to support the trail riding. So if you're doing these hard cardio workouts here, and then you go to ride your bike and you feel drained and sore, and you feel like you can't ride your bike effectively, then yes, you're overdoing it. All right. So I guess that's kind of an easy way to tell. So all right. See what else we got here before I get going on the exercise demos. What about overuse injuries in the upper joints? And swimmers and swimmer shoulders, aka swimmer shoulders. Well, see, now we're talking about athletics, and athletics is not about health and fitness. And that's one of the big kind of dirty lies out there. And I've talked about this before, like you don't ride a mountain bike to get fit. You need to get fit. That's why you should be doing strength training and mobility training and all this other stuff, because that's what gets you fit and keeps you injury resistant. Because if all you do is your sport, you're always going to run into these problems. Now, so when we're looking at athletes that have a repetitive motion, and they're always, you know, doing this, or they're throwing, or they have like, so what you're talking about is repetitive motion kind of overuse syndrome. And you can run into that, obviously, if all you do is the same things over and over again. But I guess a lot of the sporting repetitive use injuries tend to have a couple things. They tend to be either really high velocity, so like when you're throwing, you know, so there seems to be like a high power or aspect to it, or there tends to be a limited range of motion, or tends to limit the range of motion to one plane. So for example, like swimmers, you know, like they're pretty much just working in the sagittal plane. Like there's not a whole lot of, you know, transverse or gosh, geez, I'm forgetting my plane out to the side. I remember the frontal plane. That's right. Because I remember it always, it's like front should be to the front, not to the side. Anyway, sorry. And that's where, you know, having a, you know, doing a variety of exercises always comes in. But I hope that answers your question. Obviously, you can overdo anything. I mean, you can overdo drinking water. It's called drowning, right? So, but somewhere between drowning and, dehydration is what we're looking for. So Douglas wants to know best way to measure your VO2, whatever your sport is, I guess. I mean, if you're a cyclist, you should measure it cycling, because that's going to give you the greatest idea of like where you're at specific to your movement. So it's more an idea of just, I don't know, one, like just kind of how limited that number is. What does it mean? What does it mean? Why do you want to know? I mean, if it tells you that you have the highest VO2 max in the world, it's no guarantee that you're going to be the greatest endurance athlete in the world. And if you don't have a great VO2 max, then it puts like some sort of obstacle in your head that you have to overcome mentally. Like, I don't know my VO2 max, and I don't want to know it. So anyway, sorry, that's just me. I, again, these numbers just get so, I don't know, like people love numbers, man, and they're just so easy. They make the world so black and white. We got these little boxes, and it's just everything's, you know, but that's not. The world's very fuzzy and gray when we start getting into this stuff. Is VO2 max the magic thing? What about lactate threshold? Again, this stuff moves. Clive's wanting to know that. This stuff moves. So you measure your lactate threshold a day. You train for 6 months. It moves. You know, you want to know what your lactate threshold is? Where do you start panting? Okay, when you get to the point that you're having to take a deep breath, it's also called your ventilatory threshold. It's been shown to be closely related to that, to your lactate threshold. So now your ability to breathe is way more practical, right? So it makes more sense. Like, okay, if I can work harder and I'm not panting, then my fitness is getting better. You know, and so if you're thinking about your breathing, your ability to stay relaxed at these higher intensities, you know, like that's what you're wanting, not these external numbers that you, that, you know, to drive your training. Because again, this goes back to like RPE and stuff like that, and your ability to know where you're at mentally, right? So, you know, what does it matter if you know what your lactate threshold is, if you don't understand what your ventilatory threshold is? It means that, you know, practically that number doesn't mean a whole lot to you. Like, yeah, you can set these training zones based on it, but again, you know, what happens if, you know, the training zones change? Like if you went in and you measured your lactate threshold on the day that you won the lottery and, you know, you married the woman of your dreams and just all of your dreams came true, I guarantee you your numbers are going to be way higher than if you came in there and your dog got ran over, your wife ran away, your house burned down. You know what I mean? Like life stress affects this stuff. So that's what always makes me laugh a little bit when people are like, oh, I went and had this measured and now I'm basing all my training numbers on this. And it's like, man, those numbers change. They change on so many different things. They can change just based on your mental state of mind. They can change on the time of day. They can change based on the training that you've done. They can change on what you've been eating. There's so many things that can change those numbers. So again, if you're always trying to think about RPE and you're trying to think about your breathing, posture, you know, these things that have like a real practical application, trying to make the hard things feel easier, right? If you're doing something that used to feel hard and now it feels easy, that's getting fitter. You're not breathing as hard. So anyway, see, this is what happens when I go crazy and I get a little off topic there. So right. And let's see, BC Mike, should you stand and pedal? All right, I'll tell you what. I'm going to jump into, I got a couple, so here's the thing, I got these questions, but I want to make sure that I get a chance to show you guys these exercises. So I'm gonna go over the exercises real quick, and then what I'm going to do is get into answering some more of these questions, because some of them are starting to get into, some other things like training for the BC bike race or something. Amanda, we're all geeks. We love numbers. I know, man. I know. You trust me. I love my numbers. I have my moments where I have a crisis of faith where I'm like, this is too scary for me. But, you know, the truth is this is where the fun stuff lies. So Douglas, yeah, don't worry about your VO2 num. Yeah, I like that. Yep, exactly. All right. Here we go. All right. Sorry, just keeping up on some of these things here. So I'm going to jump into the exercises. Like I said, I see I have a couple other questions, but they're starting to get off of the upper body cardio training stuff. So I want to show you guys this stuff, and then we'll get back into answering questions because I love answering you guys' questions, as you can tell. So the first thing I want to show you guys is the kettlebell. The swing, like I said, is the standard exercise for doing this. The swing is one of these exercises that, like anything else, Americans like to take and think that we can improve on and make better. And so we have what's called the American swing, and then you have your Russian swing or regular swing. So I prefer the regular swing where we're projecting energy forward and back. I'm not coming all the way up over my head. I'm not going to argue whether that's right or wrong. Just for our purposes as mountain bikers, what we want to be doing is we want to be working on our ability to move our hips back and forward. So it's a back and forth projection of energy. I'm not wanting to project energy up. We use something different to work on that. So for our swings, I like to do our swings like this. Get set. Kettlebell should be a little bit in front of you. so that you can pre-hike it back. After I hike it back, I'm gonna use my hips, squeeze my hips, drive my feet heavy into the ground, nice and tall and thin at the top. Keep the arms relaxed, it's gonna float up. I'm gonna let it come back down. The trick is you wanna wait until it almost connects, like as Dan John says, like when it almost hits your zipper. Then you're going to catch it with the hips and then pop it back up. So if you watch in slow motion, I actually spend quite a bit of time in this like standing vertical plank position here. And so it's not a continual motion. Like this is not how you want to do your swings. And so it should look something along the lines like this. And done. Park it. Just like that. So that's a good swing. You can do one arm where you're going to get one arm, do one arm at a time, which is good. You're going to get a little bit of rotation down at the bottom, but you don't want to rotate too much. What you don't want is the shoulder to come out. So when I come down to the bottom here, what I don't want is the shoulder to unpack. So if I need to twist just a little bit to keep my shoulder packed in, that's fine. But not too much twisting. Don't want the shoulder to come unpacked. You know, get fancy with it. Do your pass off swings, which is, this is a good way if you're really trying to do high rep swings, or you can do like 5 or 10 on one arm and then switch off. So just a couple good swing variations. Your clean is similar to that, except you're going to hike it back, shoot the hips forward, and now we are going to pull the kettlebell up. So there's a little bit of up with the motion, and we're going to pull it up to our rack position. So again, that the upper body cardio part comes in from one, the grip, having to learn how to relax the grip and then tighten it at the right point, your grip strength endurance, doing the clean, having to catch the weight at the top, teaching how to absorb force and use your breath to do that. So all of these things are important aspects of your just kind of overall upper body conditioning and your upper body cardio. And then finally, like I said, you can do some flow drills with these things. So, you know, a real simple one, something I use in my kettlebell conditioning program is doing swings. So, say do like, you know, 10, 15 swings. When you're done, pull it up, do what this is called a goblet squat. You know, like 5 or 10 reps of this. And then finally, you can do a two-handed shoulder press like that. You know, 5 reps of that. And then right back into your swings. You know, up into your goblet squats. Back into your presses. So, obviously, you can do that one-handed. So just a great overall way to work on your upper body cardio, your overall body conditioning, grip strength, endurance. Again, I have to give credit to this little device right here that, you know, again, one of the reasons I think my programs produce the results they do, and again, the reputation they have, is because I've been using the kettlebell early and often in those programs. And so the next tool that I'm going to show you guys is an Indian club. So there's two different types of Indian club. There's a lightweight Indian club. These are like 2 pounds. They're made of plastic. They're a little bit more for some mobility stuff, which is, you know, really good. But what I want to show you guys, so these are a little lighter, you know, 1-2 pounds, and they're great as well. These are heavier. This is a 10-pound. Indian club. You ever want to really feel bad about yourself and question your strength and your you know what you really got? Grab a 10-pound Indian club and try and hold it. Like I'm making this look relatively easy because I've been training with it for a while. My grip and wrist strength has improved tremendously. But when I first grabbed these things, it's like, oh, what the frick is this? How much does this weigh? What, 10 pounds? Are you kidding me? So, you know, the leverage of these things really forces your grip and your wrist to get strong in a different way. Now, this is off subject, but I got this big, huge pet peeve with those stupid wing grips that are just showing up everywhere. And then, you know, so those little bits, I think Bergon was the first people to start making them. Those things are horrible. And then they make it impossible for you to get good palm pressure on the handlebars in the proper place, to corner properly. And they're making up for the fact that most people's grip strength and wrist strength sucks. And it's not taking care of the actual problem. It's causing problems. So you use tools like this. The kettlebell is a great tool. I've talked about using it before. But tools like this and the mace, this produces true wrist strength and stability. I guarantee you, after doing a few months with heavy mace or some heavy clubs, man, your wrists are going to feel completely different on the bike. So anyway, the leverage of these things is awesome. So the swing is the first exercise. And like I mentioned, I like these because I love kettlebells and I love the kettlebell swing. But the truth is this is not as specific a stance for us. This is not how we're standing on the bike. We use a narrow stance on the bike. In fact, we use like kind of a pedal stance or split stance type stance. And so I can replicate these stances better with the Indian club swing than I can with a kettlebell swing. So with the Indian club swings, you want to, the trick with the Indian club is learning that on the way back, you want the palms facing the ceiling. On the way forward, you want the palms facing up. And so it's this twisting. You're getting this internal and external rotation that's happening with the arms and the shoulders. And what's great is this internal rotation, as you turn back, that it locks your shoulders into place. Again, I love the kettlebell swing, but one of the things you really have to fight when you're down in this position here, it's real easy for this to happen. When you have your hands turned back and you're like this, it's very hard for this to happen. So it helps keep your upper back locked into place, and then you're actually in a better position using the Indian club swings than, you know, what most people are in with kettlebell swings. You know, you have to be really on it to keep your upper back in a good, strong position, which I'm always coaching people to do, but it's just, again, I always like what I call they're called self-limiting exercises. They're exercises that are hard to do wrong. And this is a more of a self-limiting exercise for me than the kettlebell swing, because it's harder for someone to round their shoulders like this at the bottom with Indian clubs than it is with the kettlebell swing. Point is, you can get the same benefits. You just have to think a little bit more with the kettlebell. So here's the swing. Boom. Pretty straightforward. And again, like I said, you can get into like a stagger stance position. So you're actually able to kind of do like a single leg. I always compare the stagger stance to single leg with a kickstand. So I'm trying to do like a single leg swing. That would be silly and dangerous, but I can put this little kickstand back here, keep most of my weight on this leg and do a single leg, or I can even get into my pedal stance. So you get your feet set like you're on your bike. You're able to actually replicate the same foot stance that you would have on your bike. Again, you can't do that with kettlebells. So makes it pretty cool. With that swing, you can do, obviously you can do one arm at a time. You can do what's called swing to order. You catch it up at the top. You've also got your swing to lever. So some really cool variations and stuff. You know, show you guys one more point. I like the swing to order with the lunge. So it's got a little bit more of a lower body component to it. I know today's theme is upper body cardio, but I just like the way that one feels. I really dig that one. You've got a side swing, which is out to the side. So again, if you watch from the side here, you'll see my hips. It's still a hip hinge, right? But now, it's getting a little bit different. Having to control this in a totally different plane, right? And I can go ahead and do this up into my lever holds. just like that. So that's the side swings. And then finally, you got all sorts of combo drills you can do. I mean, I showed you guys one swing to order. The real fun one that I learned from the Steve Maxwell video is go from your lever to your shield cast to your mill back to your lever. Just like that. So, you know, on the video I saw he had them doing a workout where they were doing five on one hand, switching, five of those on the other hand, and alternating back and forth for 5 minutes. And so again, it's this idea that you're able to combine these things, use them in different ways, so you continue to challenge the body without, you know, it's doing the same one thing repetitively that produces a lot of fatigue and makes you need to stop. Whereas if you're doing multiple things where the flows and stuff come in, they allow you to, you know, work longer because you're working different stuff. And so finally, I'll show you the mace. I got my it's a 15-pound mace here. I highly recommend starting with the 10. I've told the story before. I originally ordered a 10 and a 20, and I thought my little girl who works out with me from time to time would use the 10, and now I'd use the 20. So, I mean, it's 10 pounds, right? It's 20 pounds. Like, how heavy can they be? And they show up in the mail, and I go to pick things up, and I'm like, holy crap. Like, the 20-pounder was unwieldy. I couldn't even pick it up for the most part. The 10-pounder was just like, are you kidding me? So I had to make a daughter for her out of a piece of PVC pipe and rock to get her started, and ordered a lighter one. But, man, it was an eye-opening experience. So a 15-pounder, I'm not bragging here when I say this. And I'm, you know, I'm probably going to do something stupid and not make it look easy. But I just want to say, like, this is a lot harder than I'm making it look. And it is a, I'm making it look way easier than I was making it look a few months ago. So your 360 is this right here. And we're doing both ways. And you want to be able to do it with both hands on top, right? You'll find one way is easier than the other. So you got four directions, got four things basically. Both, you know, one hand on top both ways, and the other hand on top both ways. And so something to keep in mind when you're doing these, have your hands down low is the key. If your hands are above your head or, you know, high like this, this is you using the wrong muscle to try to muscle through this. So doing one of these 360s is kind of like jumping from one rooftop to the next. You just gotta do it and have faith that it's gonna come around, because if you try and control it and muscle your way through it, it ain't gonna work. Man, you guys can see the massive amount of back mobility that takes, you know, shoulder up and back endurance, just such an amazing exercise. The cousin to that is the 10 and 2. And so at this one, you don't bring it quite. So you see, like, if I was on a clock, it would be pointing at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. So that's your 10 and 2s. And finally, I'll show you the dance of death, just for fun. I was down here one night, and I'm like, how did I use this thing? I was really going to fight, you know, because these are weapons. These things were like, you know, like if you showed up on a medieval battlefield with one of these things, you wouldn't look completely out of place, right? Put a few spikes on this thing, and it's a weapon. So I'm like, people used to fight with these things. What would you do? So I kind of did a little thinking. I was like, well, I'm kind of defensive here, you know, but I can't really attack. So, but I can attack from here. I'm not very defensive, so what do I do? So get in your defensive mode, and do your, give a little space, flip, attack, flip, and back right into defend. Attack, flip. So call it the dance of death. Tongue in cheek, obviously, there. But So there you go. That's the, some of the main exercises I like to do. And like I said, I combining them together, swings, either a kettlebell or Indian club swings combined with Mace 360s. I mean, that's an amazing workout right there. And you're working on all those things. Because remember, I'm not saying that pedaling is not important. Let's back up just a little bit, because pedaling-based endurance is important. It's just not always most important. In fact, it's, for a lot of riders, it's not most important. And there's other things that you have to work on. When you're not pedaling your bike, there's other things at play. How do we train those other things that make up really a big percentage, if not the majority, of your time on the bike? Like, people would be shocked at what percentage of time they actually spend pedaling on their bike. And that other percentage, we got to find some ways to work on it. And that's where this stuff comes in. And so, different ways to use them there. So there you go. If you guys have any questions on any of those exercises or want to see some details or anything like that, let me know. I'll be happy to jump back up and show you guys. So I'm going to go through here real quick and make sure I'm not missing any questions. Anybody put down there? All right. So I do have. All right. So BC Mike's got a question here. I'm going to start diving into these questions that I took a second to show here. So should you stand and pedal in all the ESD workouts, mainly threshold 8-minute ones? So this is from a lot of my programs have my energy systems development workouts in them, but they're my version of cardio workouts. And the threshold workouts are, I was talking with one of my private training clients this morning about this. And so here's my take on it, right? I think standing paddling, like if you feel that standing paddling is a weakness of yours, then you should emphasize standing paddling in your off-season training, right? So if you, again, this is where things are a little different, for each individual rider. But for most people, I'm going to say standing paddling is a weakness. And so you should try to stand as much as you can. But you always have to let posture and breathing be your guide. That's the thing, is like you have to learn how to use standing paddling and seated paddling. So when you go into standing paddling, you realize I'm going into high tension mode. This is harder to maintain. I will eventually start to break down. When that happens, I prevent that from happening by using seated paddling to recover, or recognizing when it's about to happen and then sitting down and continuing to work in a little bit different position to recover. Because again, it seems funny, but it's like when you sit down, it helps you recover for standing. When you stand up, it helps you recover for seating. Proceed, and obviously the overall fatigue accumulation eventually kills you, but the point is that I recommend trying to stand as much as possible, especially if you've identified it as one of your weak links on the trail, which most riders it is. But it doesn't mean trying to just grind through, like, I'm gonna make it through this 8 minutes, I'm gonna bleed through my eyeballs, I will not sit down, I'm gonna put freaking nails on my seat to inflict pain if I try to sit down. That's not quite it. We want to push ourselves just a little bit further than what you would probably normally push yourself, and then sit down. Again, you're still pushing, but you're trying to focus on, when you sit down, you're able to lower the tension levels. Remember, it's all about tension management, right? So when you sit down, it should be like, I'm trying to relax. I'm trying to, relax the core, relax the muscles a little bit, let the tension dissipate, and now I can stand back up, and now I've got some tension, I basically hit my ceiling. I've got to sit down, lower the tension levels a little bit, now I can stand back up, and then your high tension training, your cardio training, strength training raises that ceiling, so it's further until you get there, and that's how you eventually get to the point where you can stand and pedal for the majority of these things. But breathing and posture are always your guide. You never want to let some external goal like that, unless it's a race, right? Somebody paying you $1 million to do it, we'll fucking do it. But if they're not, then breathing and posture. Remember, you're trying to make your hard stuff feel easier, right? Like, that's the point. Cool. Hopefully that answers your question there. BC Mike, he's got another one here. How would you prepare yourself for the Trans BC Enduro 6-day event? Man, I'm going to have to do a webinar on this one, actually. This would probably be a good subject to cover. I've helped many people do it, and honestly, they're just following the Ultimate MTB workout program. You know, that's not all. Like I'm obviously helping, you know, making some changes. But the thing is, like, I have a template, right? Like, this idea of like everyone's an individual and everyone needs a completely different workout is not true, right? 80 to 90% plus of what mountain bikers are going to do is going to be really similar across the board. Doesn't matter what discipline you are or anything like that, because we all need to push, we all need to pull, you know. There's these basic demands that we all kind of have. And then the details, right? It's like that 10 to 20% where you make those little changes in those details and stuff. And so, but my point is that the stuff that I do with my private training clients is based on the Ultimate MTB workout program. And that's the basic, that's the basis for what I've used to help people prepare for that event. And the reason that it works so well is because it goes back to what I was talking about earlier about efficiency. I'm basically, the Ultimate MTB workout program trains you to be efficient with your high tension cardio, efficient with your skills and your movement on the bike. And those two things equal you using way less energy than you normally would. And that is what allows you to be able to, you know, ride and do these things. Cause you can't train for the BC bike race. It's a 6-day event. Unless you're going to ride, you know what I mean? Like, unless you're going to ride for 6 days for that long, you can't really train for that event. So that's why you have to start finding other ways to kind of prepare for it and understand that, like, I can't prepare for it from just like a, you know, a quote unquote cardio demands where I can just go out and ride that amount for 6 days in a row. That's how you would train those specific cardio demands. You're going to have to look at efficiency, both in high tension cardio and with your skills and stuff like that. And then having a good strategy, understanding that your first couple days, you know, it's a tension management thing, right? Like, you're going to accumulate tension, and then you want to take that night, the day to relax and lower the tension levels. And then you're going to accumulate tension the next day. You need to lower it. You accumulate tension the next day, and you're going to lower it, right? And eventually, towards the end of the ride, it's going to, but the problem is if you go out day one and you're like, tension, and then you're just like, the rest of the ride, you're just like that, right? So if you manage that tension and you understand how to like pace yourself and push yourself based on RPE, not external numbers, you understand, you just have to really understand yourself and understand, like, you know, when am I switching into high tension mode? How hard can I go? Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, that's a skill. You can't external number that thing, right? So, anyways, the BC bike race is actually pretty damn easy if you follow the outline there of efficiency, high tension cardio, and you know, movement skills and stuff like that. So, I'll have to look at doing a webinar for that one in particular. So let's see here, Gary. I'm 65 and reasonably fit. My main objective is skill training. I played with a kettlebell in the store when I was trying to learn how to manual. I immediately was better because of your explanation of kettlebell swing. Excellent, man. Yeah, that, you know, and again, that idea of projecting the weight, your hips forward, because one of the big problems that people run into with manualing is they think there's some sort of backward movement, right? They either try to, you know, pull with their arms, which most people know, okay, I'm not supposed to do that because that's, you know, bending my elbows is not it. But what's happening when we bend our elbows? We're pulling back. Well, the other problem is people get told to like lean backwards or do this reverse headbutt. Well, what direction is you're going backwards, right? So that throws you off balance. And so when you understand how to throw your hips forward, and then that brings your shoulders up, not back, up, right? When you're doing a swing, you don't want your shoulders going back. If you're leaning back at the top, that's a bad swing, right? People know, tall, you know, tall and thin, you know, you don't want to lean back, squeeze your glutes, all that stuff. All that's basically saying is, like, you want to learn how to use push hips back, shoulders go down. Push hips forward, shoulders go up. There's no, you know, when your shoulders aren't moving forward and backwards at all, it's your hips moving forward and backwards, and your shoulders are just going up and down. That's the key to body position and balance on the bike. And that's one of the things the kettlebell swing teaches you how to do. So glad that worked for you, Gary. See, Nino does, you know, I'm not sure what Nino does, Nino Schurter. I'm just assuming he's the only guy, he's one of the few people in cycling that can go by one name. I'm not sure what his training is. I've had people send me videos and tell me they've seen him doing kettlebell swings and doing some things similar-ish to some of the exercises and things that I talk about. But he definitely trains. He definitely strength trains. He definitely does mobility training. You know, he's the greatest cross country racer, in a long ass time. And he's not just riding his bike. It's not just road miles, and it's not just stuff like that. So there's a huge component to that. Coordination training. I'm not really sure what, Gregory, what you're referring to with coordination training. If you want to like be a little, reply and something more specific, but just in general, are we? Let me back up a second. Because I believe that there's value in stuff that is not directly related to mountain biking. Like, if we're saying, is coordination training going to help you out as a mountain biker? No. Wait a minute. Let's back up a second here. Okay. So like coordination training, I'm thinking like things like agility ladders. They have these things with like the bouncy balls where they bounce when they're not round. They got the little knobs and they bounce to the side and you got to react and just stuff like that. I don't think that stuff has a real direct carryover to mountain biking, but the problem is we're not mountain bikers, we're human beings that mountain bike, and agility, catching, things like that. That's part of being a human being. And I do believe that that's another thing that a lot of people are missing in their training programs or elements of that. So I would encourage people to do stuff like coordination training. Just don't do it under the guise of thinking this is mountain bike specific training. This is human specific training. And you need to do it, but it's not gonna getting quick feet is not gonna help you on the mountain bike specifically necessarily. So hopefully that thing there. So the comment on grip sizes. Let's see here. All right, Nicholas said something about the comment on grip sizes. If I made a comment, I'm not sure exactly what I said, but I'll go with it. Ayal says, interested in Indian clubs, can use free weights like bicep curls, and that can be even better for the grip being thicker. Can you give an example of routine of the exercise you just showed here? Yeah, I'll show you a couple of quick things here, Ayal. You're on to something, actually, man. With what you're saying, my bicep curls, like, I can't even curl that much. Okay, I'm gonna have to like get in the middle, right? You wanna know what really gets crazy? Shoulder presses. 10 pounds, man, 10 freaking pounds right here. Right, I can press a 50, 60 pound kettlebell, no problem, but pressing this. So, and what's cool, especially with the mace, I like the maces for shoulder presses, because you can use leverage, right? So right here, easy. I'm kind of going fast and slow. I need to slow down. So I want my hand to stay parallel to the ground. That's harder. That's hard. Right? So that's the cool thing with the maces. They both have their pluses and minuses. I like the maces because there's a lot of leverage potential there. Like, I really like the maces for shoulder presses. That's like one of the main things I use for shoulder presses now, because I can micromanage. Like, when I have the 16 kilo kettlebell, I weigh 16 kilos. Like, I can turn it upside down and be bottoms up. That's pretty much my choice, either bottoms up or down here. With a mace, I can, micromanage how hard it is with the leverage aspect. And so it's just a different way. Instead of just adding load to you, you increase the leverage. The whole point of adding more load is you want your muscles to reflexively tense and produce more tension. Well, you can use leverage to produce the same thing. And if I'm able to use 10 pounds to produce this tension versus 50 or 60 pounds, which one's easier on my joints in the long run? You know what I mean? So there's a lot of different pluses and minuses with that. But yeah, you can use the things. I actually like this. This is an old school bicep curl. And then let the weights open up your hands right here. Oh yeah, that's so good. And then coming in and doing your shoulder presses. I do this for warming up a lot. But as far as like a routine goes, I'll be honest with you, I'm still kind of playing with them myself. I tend to just play with the Indian clubs. I don't, they're more of a skill thing. So like, I'll do sets, I'll set a timer and stuff like that, but it's more like just coming in and trying to play around with them and get better at the skill of using the Indian clubs. I really just kind of come in. There was a video that Steve Maxwell did. You can
think SteveMaxwellSC.com. And he's got his Indian Club Basics, which goes over his 13 favorite exercises, and he's got seminar. And, you know, so things like swings, some other ones like the shield cast that we didn't get into, the reverse shield cast, you know, like that. There's the, like I said, there's the mill, which was part of the one that we did. You can just do it on its own. You can also do the reverse mill, you know, so there's some really good exercises. But I mean, I'll tell you, I plan on coming out with some exercises or some workout programs and stuff based on this stuff as I get a better idea of exactly how to use it. Like right now, I'm more integrating the stuff into people's workouts and my workouts as opposed to really trying to train. I'm actually going to Austin to a MACE certification seminar. I'm going to be looking into, or in a couple months, I'm going to be looking into doing more stuff in this stuff. But anyways, look for some workouts coming out. I wish I could give you a quick little routine, but really at first, man, I would just say get a hold of them, a couple of 10-pound Indian clubs, and then get the Steve Maxwell video if I don't have my product out yet, and just play around with them. Play with them. Have fun. Because that's the thing, man. Like, honestly, I'm getting a little off subject, but, you know, we need to, and it just goes back to that coordination training thing that I was talking about. Sometimes we just need to play. We just need to do shit that just for the sake of being humans, you know, and learning some fun stuff and getting in and challenging ourselves with some new movement skills and stuff. So hopefully that answers your question somewhat. Amanda says she's nervous for my toes. Well, Amanda, it's never my toes that are the ones that are in danger. It's the person next to me that is in danger, because if I drop them, I know I drop them and I'm going to get the hell out of the way. So it's the person standing next to me who's in danger, which luckily no one was around me today. But that's kind of the joke with like kettlebells and stuff, when people are like, oh, you're going to drop on your toe. And it's like, dude, it's not my toe that's in danger, because I know I'm getting out of the way. Cool. Rick likes the Indian clubs. Excellent. I love the Indian clubs. Kelly's digging on it. Austin James. Douglas wants to know club or mace. Let's see here. Man, that's a tough one. If I had to tell you, I'd say get a pair of 10-pound clubs and a 10-pound mace. And that would be, you can, onnit.com, onnit.com. They sell them. They're really not that expensive. I mean, honestly, you could get a pair of 10-pound clubs and a 10-pound mace for, I mean, you'd get them shipped to your door for well under $150 for all of them. So they're not that expensive, comparatively speaking. But if I had to pick one of the two, oh man, that's tough. That is a tough one. I'd have to go with the Indian clubs, I guess. I really like the Indian club swing. I think that swing, the swing to order, the side lever holds, there's, you know, some of the stuff that you can do with it is really, you know, makes it a little more versatile and good. But the mace, man, is fun. The dance of death, brother. How could you not want to do the dance of death? So anyways, hopefully that answers your question. Yeah, James has some spikes in his personal stash of clubs. That's right, man. No, I do actually. What's funny, again, off subject, for Christmas, though, I get a throwing tomahawk, another kind of this freaking wicked-looking ornate throwing axe. I got darts, a 15-pound mace, some ninja stars. I'm like looking at my stuff that I got for my Christmas and my birthday. Oh, yeah, my birthday money, I go and buy other maces. Anyways, and I started looking at it. I'm like, dude, what is wrong with me, man? People think I'm a very violent person. But man, dance of death. So see, man, during upper body cardio work, if it's lower to mid-back tension, sign that I'm doing something incorrectly. No. You want, well, you know, there's a difference between tension and pain. And, you know, because it's a muscle, right? So your low back is a muscle. And so you're going to feel it. Like, you know, you're going to want it to work. Just like when doing deadlifts, right? Like when people, we get scared of thinking like, oh, if I feel anything in my lower back, that's bad. And that's not necessarily true. Like they're muscles, you should feel them. But there's a difference between when they're moving, when they're creating movement and you're getting like joint compression, you know, then that's different than when it's just kind of muscles. Work and you're feeling some muscle fatigue and some muscle, action there. So, you know, it's like anything else. You always err on the side of caution. There's never an excuse to get hurt in training. But, you know, I wouldn't worry about it too much because, again, like, you're going to be starting out relatively light with this stuff. And so it's going to be kind of hard to overdo it again. Like, that's what I like about this stuff is the weights are so low. It's like, yeah, doing a Mace 360 with a 10-pound club is hard, but it's only 10 pounds. You know what I mean? Like, you really have to screw up to tweak your back out. And again, I know someone will take that as a challenge, but please don't. But anyway, so yeah, it's like I said, it's kind of, you got to learn to judge between muscular kind of fatigue and like joint pain. And, but feeling a little work, man, that's good. You want that. That low back needs to work. It needs some, work. So BC Mike, this is my second season with your program. Love it. First year racing, I was placing 30th. Last season, I cracked the top 10 in Masters. Keep it coming. Excellent, BC Mike. Glad to hear it, brother. That's the kind of stuff I like to hear. So, yeah, you're on track, man. Just keep doing what you're doing. And, maybe get some longer rides in towards more just to mentally give yourself the confidence. Like, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can sit in the saddle for that many hours. Yeah, I can do that. But you're well on track, man. I just keep doing what you're doing. You've been doing this in your second season and seeing these kind of results already. You'll probably surprise yourself. All right. Gary says, I worked on the whole patch in my 20s and learned how to use a sledgehammer a lot. Sledgehammer is just a repurposed modern day mace, right? Instead of cracking heads, we're cracking rocks. Ever since I've always had a really good upper body strength. I didn't know I was mountain bike training before they, yeah, exactly, man. That's it, man. Mountain bike training before they even had mountain bikes. So, man, that's, you know, the old school. I've had this epiphany lately that you don't meet people who have a strong grip who have a weak core, but you meet plenty of people who have a strong core, but their grip strength sucks ass. Are we going about this backwards? Grip strength really equal core strength, right? Like, it goes back to that equation I talked about earlier. So, yeah, it's the grip strength and core strength is go hand in hand. So yes, perfect. All right, what was the recommended weight for your first pair of Indian clubs? And Brian wants to know, and I recommend 10 pounds. I think I mentioned that earlier, 10 pounds is a good place to start. And it's kind of like a 12 kilo kettlebell where for a lot of people, you need to start there because you just have these gaping holes in these areas that these things expose. Like, you're going to find out my grip and wrist strength suck ass, but your grip and wrist strength are going to get strong real quick because your body's going to recognize like, oh, this is an authentic movement challenge. I need strong grip. I will get stronger, right? It's not some made up gym BS. And so, half the core training exercises out there are just this made up crap, you know? And then you freaking throw a weighted Indian club in your hand and you start doing something simulating, you know, twirling around your head. And it's like your brain starts waking up going like, ah, yes, I know how to do this. This is, you know, from my past. Someone in your past has swung something around their head like that, probably a sword or something. But there's something primal about these movements that really starts to wake up stuff in your head. So my point is that you're going to start to see results from it. You're going to get strong with it quickly. So just be prepared that, you know, in the next 6 months to a year, you're probably going to want to invest in the next level up heavier ones. But it's kind of like, you know, if you start too heavy, you can't learn it. So you almost kind of have to start with something that you know is eventually going to become a little too light, because that's what's going to help you learn the skills that are going to allow you to use the heavier stuff. So anyways, hopefully that answers your question there. Yeah, I mean, juggling to use the TRX bands too. Yeah, I've got all sorts of tricks up my sleeve there, Gregory. So, all right, I think that's about it. I don't see any other questions. If anybody else has anything and they want to like jump in before I take off, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. It was awesome getting a chance to talk to you guys and getting to answer your questions and share some of my knowledge with you. Douglas, appreciate it. Appreciate doing this. You guys taking the time to do it with me, man. I love these webinars. Love getting a chance to talk to you guys. So, I guess that's going to be it. See a couple of little things popping in here and there, get some forearm pump. That's right. it will definitely do that. You know, it's funny though, man, is it, it's like anything else. It's like, you know, when if you don't train it, it's not going to get better. And unfortunately, grip strength is not going to get better with like the little dyno balls and the wrist rollers and stuff. It's just, that's not the kind of grip strength that we need on the trail. And so these tools here, like I said, the kettlebell, if you're following one of my programs already, you've got this in there, right? Because I've got kettlebell swings, I've got the Turkish get-ups, I've got the kettlebell stuff in these programs. And so you've already got this secret weapon in your programs. I'm just hoping to be able to kind of enhance this stuff and give you guys some other and better options. So excellent. All right, guys. Well, that's going to be it. Appreciate everybody signing out. I will thank you guys for your time. And I look forward to doing another one of these. And again, you guys got any suggestions on topics you'd like to see covered, hit me up at james@bikejames.com and let me know. And I'll see what I can do to work it in there. But awesome. Well, cool. Oh, Amanda threw one in here. Threw in the last question. Yes, cheers from Germany. Thanks, Steph and I all. Hey, all, let me know if you get the Indian clubs and what you think about them. And all you guys, if any of you guys get this stuff and work with them, let me know what you think. I'm definitely interested to hear what your guys' take on it is. So Amanda's saying a little off topic, but about your stand on pedals. I've been riding with my foot in the middle of the pedal and noticed a huge difference climbing. It was a bit awkward descending to try and drop my heel though. Yeah, you know, here's, and this again, off topic. The dropping the heel thing is, it's kind of funny. You realize like there's things that we did and teach people to do because we're just trying to figure out how to work around a shitty platform. Okay, so I don't want to drop my heels. What I want to do is shift my weight to my heels, right? So again, like I'll, if I'm here, right, and I want to shift, I want to get even further. That's what we're talking about. I'm starting to go downhill. So when I start to go downhill, I want to shift my weight even further back. Now, here's the problem. I can't fucking do this on my toes. It's impossible. I mean, look, I can't do it. So the answer was drop your heels. And that dropping your heels helped you sit your hips back. But you're not wanting to drop your heels. You're wanting to sit your hips back. If you sit your hips back, it will see how my toes start to come off of the ground and my heel is weighted now. That's what I'm looking for on the pedal. So when you go to get back, I'm not dropping my heels. I'm shifting my hips back. And that shifting my hips back is what makes my heels drop because I'm weighting my heels. But if you don't have anything underneath your heel and you're balanced on the ball of your foot and you're on this unstable platform, your foot doesn't want to do that. Your foot doesn't, you know, let your body doesn't let you move that way because it's not balanced and stable. And so you have to make up this crazy crap like drop your heels. But the only reason you're having to drop your heels is because you're balanced on the balls of your feet and you can't shift your hips back when you're balanced on the balls of your feet. So if you get off the balls of your feet, then you can start focusing on the real thing, which is shifting your butt back. So focus on shifting your butt back and let the heel drop and the weighting of your heel happen as a result of you shifting your hips back. Not the other way around. You're not dropping your heel to get your hips back. You're shifting your hips back, and that weights your heels. So cool. Hopefully that answers your question. Yes, urban legend. Amanda, you would be shocked at how much advice you guys get for your skills training stuff and bike riding stuff. It's just absolutely BS. It has no reality in movement or anything, and it's just, it's crazy, right? I talk all the time about elbows out. It's not elbows out. It's lats engaged, right? If my lats aren't engaged, it's here. But my lats can be not engaged and have my elbows out. I call this the scarecrow. We see this all the time. It's a freaking the scarecrow syndrome of people out there with their elbows out to the side like this. It's like, elbows out. I look like I'm a pro. Elbows out. It's like, dude, your upper back is still fucking, there's no tension there. You know what I mean? You're missing it. If you get your elbows too far out, now your hand pressure is going down. You're not able to drive in and counter steer and all that stuff. So, you know, it's not elbows out. It's tuck your shoulder blades. Oh, hey, guess what happens when I tuck my shoulder blades in my back pocket? It pushes my elbows out. So it's the same thing, right? You know, dropping your outside foot when you corner, it's bullshit. That's not what you do. You shift your hips to the outside. It's the same thing as dropping your heel. Your weight shift, weights the foot. So as your hips shift to the outside, that weights the foot. And as you weight the foot, that's what makes it drop. The further your hips shift, the more you're weighting, the further it's going down. It's not the other way around. You're not dropping your foot to shift your hips. You're shifting your hips to drop your foot. You know what I mean? But it's this backwards crap, because when you don't understand movement and you don't know what you're looking at, you start looking at symptoms. You see someone with their heels dropped and you're like, oh, well, dropping his heels is what he did. No, he shifted his hips back, and shifting his hips back dropped his heels. But, again, if you don't understand that as a coach, then you're going to miss that. And you're going to tell people to do stuff like elbows out and drop your heels and reverse headbutt people and just nonsense after nonsense after nonsense that I hear people telling stuff. So anyway, sorry, got a little off topic there. Cool. Got people saying thanks. Appreciate the great stuff. Urban Legend, looking forward to the Catalyst pedal. You're going to love it, Ayal. Promise, man. Thing's awesome. What is the name of the flat pedal you developed? Okay, Gregory. Oh, Ayal already hooked him up, man. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah, the Catalyst pedal, pedaling innovations. But again, I know this wasn't meant to be talking about the pedal, but that's, really the pedal is spawned from the same problems I was just talking about. It's people that don't understand how the human body really moves, trying to tell you how to apply this crap to the bike. A lot of just myths and urban legends and things that have been repeated so many times and nobody questions it. But your foot needs to be stable, and the only way it can be stable is if it's supported on both ends of the arch. And the Catalyst pedal is the only pedal in the world that does that. And so it's the only pedal in the world that will allow you to apply your natural movement and power. And all these things that I'm talking about here, this thing that drives me nuts, it's like we teach you to move one way in the gym, right? Every one of these coaches will tell you, like, yeah, you need to squat and deadlift. You need to keep your heel down, push through your heel, blah, 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 blah. But then you get on the bike and I need you to push the ball in your foot. What? Why? Why? I'm not applying the same movement that I'm working on the gym to the bike because my foot's in a different place. And so if my foot's in a different place, and that changes from the brain's point of view, it changes muscle recruitment, it changes balance, it changes everything. And so you can't apply what you're getting in the gym to the bike on those tiny little pedals. So anyways, there you go. All right, that's a good enough rant for the day to end off. All right, everybody's saying thanks. I think that's it. So unless someone slips another question in there real quick, I'm really going to sign off this time. So anyways, once again, man, it's been a lot of fun. Hope you guys get some good ideas from the seminar, and hopefully answer some questions for you with the Q&A. And I will talk to you guys next time.